everybody.
Good morning.
Here we are again. And welcome to autumn. The weather is shifting. It's such a relief to have some coolness. Today I wanted to talk about the first of the four great Bodhisattva vows in relation to our practice. And the first one is, beings are numberless, I vow to free them. How do we do that? Do you know how to free all beings? All the numberless beings? I don't. And it's really, to start off with, it's not really a matter of knowing. This is a vow. And when we take a vow, we don't really need to know how we're going to embody that vow. But we're going to be informed by what we meet in our life and the intention to free all beings. And the only way we can approach that, the only way I can approach that, is to wonder in this very moment, what does that mean? Where is the freedom in this moment? So when we're sitting in Zazen, you know, I mentioned sweeten the heart. That's one possibility, is where is the, you know, we can have this automatic response to situations that are difficult, worrisome, perplexing, beyond our ability to cope. And so one of the things that we can do, and one of the things that we practice, is sweetening the heart. That won't take us in the wrong direction. So let's start with why we practice. Why do we practice? It's a really important question to be clear about for ourselves, or to practice. Okay, what in this moment? Why am I practicing? Because the response to that, or the insight into why I'm practicing right now, can vary, can change. But it's important to know what is my expectation of this practice. What is my inmost request of it, and of myself, and of my life? And how does my practice serve this inmost request? So we all have intentions. We have the narrow momentary intentions, and then we have the broader intentions. And sometimes we're really clear about what our intentions are, and sometimes not so clear. Sometimes they're quite hidden. So why do you practice? Why do you practice? Why do you practice? Yeah.
Just to bring greater peace and just peace to my life, I guess.
Okay. So that's one reason. What about somebody else? What do you practice, Kelly?
Same. Peace and calmness.
Brings calm.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody else?
To quiet your mind.
The contentment thing goes up.
Contentment.
A little less self.
Less self. What would be another way of saying that?
No self.
No self. Being able to come from a broader view than just
that's
what.
Mine.
Yeah, Lord, better mind. Yeah, Scott.
Practice to release all beings.
To release all beings, in whatever way that might be.
Right.
Anybody else? One more. Yeah.
Return to ape nature, stop deciding.
Return to ape nature, stop deciding.
Yes.
Okay. Relinquishing control to something more primary. And people, so there are all kinds of reasons why people practice. And the expected, this is a pretty settled group. This range of answers is pretty, comes from a sense of really specific engagement with the practice. Some people practice to feel healthier because the doctor has recommended meditation, because the blood pressure is getting too high. To feel calmer, to feel more in control or less in control, depending on your point of view. Or you begin to practice when you've lost a job or a partner. You're grieving. You're grieving for something in particular, or just in general, how your life has gone, or the world. Or you have a question, like, who am I, or what am I supposed to be doing with my life? There are all kinds of things that bring us initially into practice before we really get what the enormity of the scope of the effect of continuous practice is. So that first vow, beings are numberless, I vow to free them, underlies this vow, whether we know it or not, underlies it. We're all coming to be free to feel more peaceful, to be free to live in a larger and less selfish way, these are various ways that we personally experience freedom. And if we persist with regular practice, it becomes a way of life. It reveals itself to be profoundly transformative. This is not a hobby. This isn't a hobby practice. It's not something that reveals its full treasure to any kind of casual look. It requires, to the extent that we commit, we receive. To the extent that we give, we receive. And it's subtle. You can ask, you know, I ask people when they've just started to practice, and they're saying, oh yeah, this is really good. I say, so what is it that you get? And you may not be able to describe what changes. This transformation begins immediately. What changes? I'm not sure what it is. It's just that I am a little bit less uptight, or however you would express it. I surprise myself by being just a little bit more patient or less bent out of shape about things that ordinarily would really get to me. That's a portion of freedom. Not only that in the direction of self that we experience that freedom, but imagine if you were less reactive, the person who you might have gone off on is free from that explosion, that tension. So how do we free all beings? This question, the four great vows, beings are numberless, I vow to free them. That's a koan. It's a very profound question that we can only live into or live out of, in or out. There's no answer to it. Oh, how do I free all beings? This, and this. It's not the way we come to have insight into this, into our life. It happens moment by moment, day by day, situation by situation. That's what makes up our life. This Zen way is so simple and direct, and through it over time we develop an ability to live much more simply, much more directly, much more authentically in our moment by moment way. A word that's often used by people to describe the experience is, I feel more in alignment with what's going on. I'm less up against it. I'm less trying to take a posture to oppose. live in alignment with the Bodhisattva way. But some people are really put off by Zen. They're put off by all the ritual. A lot of people come once and they say, I just don't like this ritual, all this ritual stuff. And some of you might also have that feeling, but you put up with it because something else is really good, which is fine. But I thought it might be really useful today to talk about how all of the different aspects of practice that we teach in our particular offering, our lineage, has to do with freeing all beings, how they all function. So I'm talking about Zazen, liturgy, what we chant, what we study, the bowing, the inclusion in practice of samu or work, the emphasis on bringing our spiritual practice into every moment, every kind of activity, the precepts, receiving precepts. We'll be having a precept ceremony in October. There are 5 people in this Sangha who are preparing to receive precepts, which is a clear ethical set of behavioral guides that help us pay much closer attention. And then our relationships, how we work with our relationships. This practice, I mean, why bother to do it if it doesn't really transform how we show up in the world and what we bring to the world directly in an embodied way, or indirectly in a disembodied way through our virtual lives. Most of us are on computers. There's all kinds of behaviors that are extremely difficult that happen in the virtual world that we have some restraint about in our actual world. It's probably one of the things that's contributing to the sudden uptick of extremely kind of violent and just out there behavior by people, hate-based behavior. So these are different ways in this practice that we practice with this vow of freeing all beings. So I wanted to look a little bit more closely at them. First, Zazen. Zazen is a hidden discipline of familiarity and intimacy. When we sit Zazen, we are alone with ourselves. Maybe the only times we ever are. We don't have something else going on. Radio, the cell phone, whatever. When we sit and the instruction is just breathe and keep attention on the breath, it's a very intimate practice. Are we willing to be free enough to be intimate with our own stream of consciousness? And we learn to tolerate it initially. And then the stream of consciousness, the stream of chatter, quiets down occasionally, a bit, sometimes. And we experience a taste of the enormity of consciousness, of the non-material, of the spiritual, of all of the energies of the world. So we allow the mental beehives that labor day and night to go quiet, or the water wheel of thoughts to come to rest sometimes. And thus we can notice actually the present moment, which is always right here and stretches infinitely. The present moment is an infinite moment. All of the clock moments that demarcate our activities are not actual. We have agreed to organize ourselves accordingly, but when we get to the actual, there's just this infinite flow of just this, and flow of not knowing. So that's the other part of practice, is to let go of the knowing mind, the mind that knows, the mind that names, the mind that says this and not that, the mind that chooses. It takes great courage, actually. It's a courageous practice. It's a natural way of being, but it's courageous for modern humans to undertake this quieting down, to be willing to be present to the unknown and the unknowable. This direct life of ours is unknowable. It's not a matter of knowing. It's a matter of is. So surrendering to unknowing is part of the intimate discipline of Zazen. And it is the very agent of transformation of this way of life. Because when we can unknow during, when we can just drop knowing during Zazen, that generalizes into our life. And so I find myself often being in a situation that is being described in a certain way, but to me clearly it's not just that way. We could describe it in a million different ways. Realization of unknowing. I'm sure you all have that experience where somebody's saying it's this or it's that and you're thinking, not really. So that's a kind of freedom. And that presents us with choices and also a lot of responsibility. How are we going to remain engaged in the world in a loving way when we see through some of its terms? I wanted to share a poem, just because I love to do that, as you know. That's actually about waking up in the morning, but it's actually about just waking up, period. I mean, as I read it, I think, whoa, this is really about waking up. And it's called What to Remember When Waking. In that first hardly noticed moment in which you wake, coming back to this life from the other, more secret, movable, and frighteningly honest world where everything began. There is a small opening into the new day, which closes the moment you begin your plans. What you can plan is too small for you to live. What you can live wholeheartedly will make plans enough, we'll make plans enough for the vitality hidden in your sleep. To be human is to become visible while carrying what is hidden as a gift to others. To remember the other world in this world is to live in your true inheritance. In that first hardly noticed moment in which you wake, coming back to this life from the other, more secret, movable, and frighteningly honest world where everything began, there is a small opening into the new day which closes the moment you begin your plans. What you can plan is too small for you to live. What you can live wholeheartedly will make plans enough for the vitality hidden in your sleep. To be human is to become visible while carrying what is hidden as a gift to others. To remember the other world in this world is to live in your true inheritance. I came across this poem in a continuing ed class that I have to take for my therapy license on sleep and insomnia. And it was terrific, it was really interesting. I wish some of the people who don't sleep that I know had been with me. It was profoundly accurate. But one of the things that he said, he said over and over in various ways, is that we think about our waking life as our life and our sleeping life as something that, you know, that's the way he showed it, just But actually, we could, and then he gave all kinds of evidence for this, say that we actually basically are always sleeping. We're always dreaming. And what distracts us from the dream in its various qualities, sleeping and waking, dreaming, is our addiction to wakefulness, is our addiction to activity, which flips over. It's really an interesting thought. I mean, we don't have to argue whether it's true or not true or anything, but it flips the usual description in a way that's quite fertile. Right? So then he brought up this poem. So opening the inner eye is quite open in our dream life. It's quite open. It's not so limited. It's not so confined by conventional demands. So it can really roam quite powerfully in the deeper realms of our experience. And that's true in Zazen. That's very true in Zazen. We become much more aware in our waking dream of all of the things that we don't notice that are part of our life and part of what shows us the way in our life, the more complete way. So that's the first of the things that come to us in practice. The next thing would be liturgy. And this brings up that whole idea of choreography, which many of you have heard me talk about. The thing about Zen is that looks so tight-assed, really, is that everything's prescribed. Look at these robes. You sit here. You do this, you bow. Everything's prescribed. It's a choreography. And the idea behind it, or the kind of genius of the choreography of this particular practice, is we learn it. We move as a troupe, which we're always in a troupe whether we know it or not. We're moving in alignment, which is quite healing, and it's quite true. And then also, in our formal practice, we don't have to make decisions. We just do it. Which is really freeing us potentially from the mind that constantly has to be sorting into the particulars and making choices, so that we are free to open the mind out of that concern. That's what the choreography of practice is all about. We could say all of the offering, the whole way, the Zen way is a huge choreography. It's a choreography that allows us to realize our whole life and to express our whole life. So we chant, and our chanting service are, the chants are teachings, and they're commitments that help realize this way of life. When we use the word realize, this is in the sense of experiencing for ourselves. It's like, oh, okay, I get it. Oh, right? It's realization. And we can develop a sense of ongoing openness or not knowingness. So every time we meet on Sundays, this is the Sunday thing, we chant the verse of the Kesa. The Kesa is the Buddha's robes. That chant is there because some of us, or in varying ways all of us, have a devotional heart. There's a certain kind of devotional energy. That's kind of the sweetness in the heart, is the devotional aspect. So when we evoke the Buddha's robe, we're really feeling in the body the protection and the kind of the entire umbrella of awakening, teaching, support, encouragement, and love that comes in this practice. It's a very intimate image, very personal. Then we chant the Heart of Great Wisdom Sutra. the shortest of the versions. There are a number of versions of that. The longest one is 800,000 lines. But we figure we don't have enough time on Sunday for that one. And that is a description of the unfabricated character of every thing, including ourself. The underlying unfabricated character, which the teaching is all about impermanence, that there is no actual separation that is to be realized in the nature of everything and ourselves. And that underlying all of the impressions that we have is a vast, vast and untampered with nature, emergence. And so we can really shift our emphasis, our emphasis on the emerging nature of our life rather than the fixed nature of our life. And we chant the identity of relative and absolute, which is a description of how things emerge in their particular forms and qualities, because our whole life is filled with particularities, which are real. The self has a reality to it. This has a reality to it, everything. In what way? That's what this identity of relative and absolute describes. So there's a self that wakes up in the morning and goes to bed at night and brushes the teeth and reads a book or climbs a mountain. And at the very same time, this self is impermanent and relies entirely for its ongoingness on conditions remaining constant. The heart continuing to beat, pumping blood, the mind continuing to think, lift the feet in walking, etc. The muscles and nerves continuing to coordinate with each other. So it's all about what changes and what doesn't change is always emerging together. There is no separate absolute. And then on alternating weeks, we chant the precious mirror samadhi, which evokes the quality of suchness, the quality of that intimate quality that we have when we have a direct and when we have an intimate experience with something, there's no separation experienced.
Unmitigated.
Unfettered.
Unfettered, unmitigated, yeah, uninterfered with. A real sense of intimacy, which happens to us all the time. Did anybody here have a moment like that this morning?
Not this morning, but the difference between seeing a picture of a total eclipse and actually seeing the total eclipse was...
It's a great example, yeah. Mm-hmm. Direct. It's direct. There's nothing in between. It's just all happening. It's all happening, man. And it's always true. There's nothing that separates us ever. When I was taking a shower this morning, there was a little moth that was caught in the fold of the shower curtain. And there it was. It was its last life. A drop of water hit it, and that was it. And it was flapping around, and that's a little. I mean, an eclipse is a big, and then there's a little moth in the shower. We're noticing a bubble when you're washing the dishes pop, or whatever, little, big. Then we chant the chant of boundless compassion, which is a basic, maybe inspiration to awaken to our continuous open-heartedness, to receive the open heart, to give the open from an open heart, and to realize the open heart, to be present. And finally, we chant the Jizo Dharani. And a Dharani is it's kind of a long mantra. So it doesn't have to have specific cognitive meaning. It's much more energetic. So Jizo is the bodhisattva who embodies the energies of great determination, courage, unflagging optimism, and a warm and tender heart. And so we chant the Jizo drawing before we go forth into the day to summon these energies, to remember them, to evoke them in us. This is a Dharani that's chanted in many, many parts of the world. The beings are numberless, I vow to free them. So we engage the liturgy to as a way of receiving the voices of wise and loving friends, remembering, being advised by the ancients. Wholesome guides to go deep. We study the sutras, we listen to Dharma talks. And, you know, many of us who've been practicing for a very long time and started, you know, many years ago, were discouraged from reading or listening to teachings. We were encouraged just to sit, to have our own direct experience. Because we all bring to practice when we begin all kinds of ideas about what it is. And unless we have a certain body of experience ourselves, we can really misunderstand the words that are being spouted about practice. And it can really hang us up and lead us in the wrong direction. Which is one reason why it's extremely important to have a teacher. Because if you're like me, I have and continue to see into all kinds of ideas I have about practice. And it's very, very helpful to be able to consult with somebody who's slightly ahead on the path or who has had the same experience and has some wherewithal with it in practice. There are all kinds of things that come up. And one of the basic ideas is this is a bliss activity. Well, yeah, there are moments of bliss, but that's a state of mind. That's not the whole thing. So if you're really engaging practice, you're going to come up, you're going to learn about all the energies in yourself and all the hang-ups and all the things that have been not dealt with. So there's a lot of difficulties that come up, and you can think, oh, I'm not really practicing right, because if I were, I wouldn't be having this problem. So we come in with this sense of we're going to transcend the whole business of being a human being, which is really important to have a guide to help you make your way with that complexity. And then bowing is another one. Bowing, there are several different aspects to bowing. It's a body practice. Just the experience of bowing and touching the earth with the forehead. How many of us spend any time touching the earth with our head, with our minds, with our bodies, together? No separation. It also feels really good if you've been sitting for a long period of time to bow, you're stretching your back, and really, it's great. In a way, it's a respect for the way, in gratitude to all the Buddhas and the fully awake, mature human beings who have maintained the path open for us for the many, many thousands of years. And it's also an appreciation for the Sangha, who are our companions in this practice. And then we bow, just to bow, because we are ordinary and we have a body, and it's a good way to use it. It's a way that creates no harm. We practice Samu while working, bringing our complete presence into all of the tasks of the day. And knowing that all the work that we do is a contribution to the collective living community. And so we we do our work as an offering, and we do our work as receiving with gratitude the ability to offer, to contribute. You know, we used to talk about how work is ennobling. We don't hear much about that anymore, but it's true. It's so important for kids to have chores. They grow up feeling competent and knowing that they can think about how to approach a task. Same for all of us. Work is a we do it anyway. Let's do it with full heart. And then there are precepts, which are behavioral guides for happiness and well-being. And they point us to a foundational awareness. They set us on the track of looking at how everything we do creates the world that we live in with others. Everything we do is a contribution to how the whole community goes. So beings are numberless. I vow to free them. In all of these ways. We're always in relationship. And our practice helps us honor in every which way all of our relations. So not only are we freeing ourselves from our own confusion and self-centeredness and restlessness, but we bring our own example of that freedom into our neighborhoods. And we learn how to connect not only with our own projections, because in this don't know mind, there's always the possibility that what I think is going on, what I think you mean, may not be actually what's going on. So there's a openness to hearing, to getting more back. And then we can respond to the actual needs of the worlds around us. So you know that line in the verse of the Kesa, how great the robe of liberation, a formless field of benefaction. This entire practice is a formless field of benefaction, every aspect of it. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them from my own unskillful ways, the ways that I live without skill, a self-centered, limited ways that I have. So how do we free them? Moment by moment, we free ourselves and all beings, moment by moment in our continuous practice, by embracing this vow, living by vow. The vow to keep going with every last breath, this very open, sweet, and lively way. Enjoy the practice.
Please turn to page 5 of your chant book, located under the front corner of your cushion. Four great bodhisattva vas.